Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
After decades of desire, we finally made the nearly four-hour-long drive up to Tum Tum Lake to camp, canoe, and explore the area. Upon first sight of the lake, its beauty astounded us, as its deep turquoise color and its alpine mountain backdrop reminded us of Lake Louise. In some ways, it was better to have waited this long to make the journey, as for years I've heard how the area had been devastated by clear-cut logging, and now at least the logged-over landscape is filled with mostly healthy, fast-growing plantations. However, we did drive by two areas that had been planted with lodgepole pine that appear to be quite anemic-looking, as this species is not native to this interior wetland ecosystem. In the 1990s, I participated in the Kamloops Land and Resource Management Planning Process, which was the first one for the province. Through intense negotiations with the forest industry, we were able to create the 5,733-hectare Upper Adams River Provincial Park that includes Tum Tum Lake, along with a strip of land along the entire stretch of the river between the two lakes and between the logging roads that run parallel to the river. Despite its park status, not a dime has been spent to improve the two former forestry recreation campsites, and we could not even find a park sign. We chose to camp at the lower site, where there are some trees and one old, worn picnic table, as the other site is a large open area with no amenities. It took us only 3 hours to canoe around the lake, keeping close to the shore to avoid any sudden dangerous rough water from the frequent winds. At the far end, where the upper Adams River enters the lake, there's an enormous sandbar that forms a perfect beach. Although the lake is very picturesque, it is far from pristine, and there are actually two cabins. One, a very small log building, is next to the campsite and belongs to a trapper who still uses it every winter. A hunting guide built the other log cabin, and the lease was grandfathered when the park was created, and now a family uses it as a summer cottage. We learned from the cottage owner how the small glaciers that can be seen from the lake and are the source of the glacial silt that colors the water, turquoise, have melted significantly over just the last 10 years. Back at the campsite, we were intrigued by the constant sound of rushing water. The next day, we paddled to the east side of the bay and found a short trail that leads to the approximately 12-foot-high waterfall at the outlet of the lake. It is this roaring sound that likely gave the lake its name, which is a Chinook jargon word for the pulsing of the heart. Prior to the logging, there was once an extensive ancient old-growth cedar hemlock rainforest surrounding Tum Tum Lake and extending up the valley and along the tributaries. The provincial park now protects small remnants of these over 1,000-year-old trees, although these trees are not as large as old-growth found elsewhere due to the lack of soil richness. A few kilometers to the north of the lake is another small 286-hectare park, Oregano Creek, named by famed BC lichenologist Trevor Goward, for a rare type of oceanic lichen found there. Goward has developed the term antique to describe BC's rare old-growth interior rainforest, which helps explain how these forests are far older than the oldest trees in them. We also made a side trip up the Oliver Creek drainage, where a massive zinc mining exploration project is underway in the Alpine near Ruddock Creek. The views along this logging road are magnificent, especially seeing the waterfalls that stream off the remnant glaciers still clinging to the peaks. Since Tum Tum Lake does not have a Sequoyah name, it is possible the Shuswap people did not have settlements there due to its distance from larger settlements and its inhospitable geography and weather. However, the 1904 diary of English settler Spencer Tuck, who spent two winters trapping and gold panning along the Adams River 20 miles north of Adams Lake, describes the remnants of a settlement. Quote, "There is every indication of this having been a large Indian camp sometime, as there are remains of old sweat houses and wigwams all around."
Canoe Victory Hall, Victorious Again by Estelle Noakes, read by Patty Doherty. The First World War was known as the Great War, or the War to End All Wars. It was the most widespread war in history to that time, with the word freedom as its mantra. An unprecedented catastrophe, it shaped our modern world. The aftermath of this war was felt in every community across Canada, including the small village of Canoe. Surveyors for the Canadian Pacific Railway in the 1880s found an old dugout canoe in the mud at the entrance to a nearby creek and promptly called the place Canoe. 3 years after the completion of the CPR through the area in 1885, the first white settler, John Hakanlund, arrived from Norway. His wife and son joined him in 1890. Their daughter, Hilma, was the first white child born at Canoe. In 1910, John Lund had the town site of Canoe surveyed. When the First World War began, the village of Canoe was in its infancy. Nevertheless, 19 local men enlisted to serve their country. The residents survived by logging, working for the CPR, and later with orchards and farming. There were always fish to be caught in the lake and berries on the hillsides. The first school was built in 1897. In 1913, a wharf was built, and their sternwheelers played a significant part in the development of the community. Canoe was described by Wrigley's Directory in 1919 as a post office and flag station on the CPR, 7 miles east of Salmon Arm, with a government telephone, public hall, and splendid dock. Local resource is fruit farming. The first church was built in 1921, as well as a packing house. A mill was built in 1926, providing much-needed jobs. At that time, the population was 125. There were only 65 residents listed in the census in 1919, increasing to 75 in 1920 as the soldiers returned home. In celebration of the Empire's victory in the First World War, residents of the community of Canoe decided to build Victoria Hall. It was a labor of love and thankfulness that accomplished what was to prove to be a very important addition to their community. A building collection was taken up in the district, but when more money was needed, several old-timers loaned the extra funds to finish the hall. A Mrs. Fraser collected the donations totaling $700. The land was donated by John Hakanlund. The timbers, other building supplies, construction costs, and even the furniture were all donated by community members. The hall is a one-story wood frame structure located in the center of the village. A sign, in the shape of a canoe, with the name Victory Hall inscribed upon it, was hung over the front door. When the residents realized that there were 11,000 Victory Halls across the nation, the name was changed to Canoe Victory Hall. A wooden plaque was hung on the wall listing the names of those who had served their country. Of the 19 young men, 4 did not return. The names of those who survived are L. E. Brown, H. H. Evans, H. Evans, H. Johnson, L. J. W. McLeod, H. Tetlock, J. Tetlock, J. Dalzell, R. Riddle, G. Chaplin, L. Hart, H. Timpson, T. Pegg, A. Widmark, and R. Wilkinson. The 4 killed in action were M. Tetlock, R. Lye, E. H. Wright, and R. Stockton. A photograph of John H. Lund contained a dedication below was also hung in the hall in thanks for his generous donation of the land. Later, when the South Canoe Hall was built, Victory Hall became known as the North Canoe Community Hall, or North Hall. After World War II, another commemorative plaque was placed on the wall listing the 44 men and women who served their country in that war. Victory Hall was utilized as a place of public worship by the Methodists, Presbyterians, and Anglicans until their churches were built in the community. As well, it became the hub for all sorts of social and cultural events. Its uses included Armistice Day celebrations, dances, drama, music, concerts, wedding and baby showers, box socials, reunions, work bees, exercise, bingo, meetings, badminton, election polling stations, and educational purposes. Events often featured the music of local bands and artists. There are many residents of Canoe who share fond memories of attending functions in the hall. Barb Gray, great-great-granddaughter of John Lund, remembers the hall as the social center of the community. Everyone was welcome to attend any event, which meant there could often be over 100 people at even a baby or wedding shower. Barb was married in the hall, as were all her friends. She remembers always buying a new dress for the big New Year's Eve gala and all the fun they had at the hall with music and dancing. Victory Hall has been added to several times since it was built and maintained well through the years by the North Canoe Community Hall Association. In May of 2013, it was added to the Salmon Arm City Heritage Register. Their report states, Victory Hall is valued for its historic, cultural, and social significance within the community, particularly its role in commemorating the Empire's victory in World War I and for its historic use as a place of public worship and continued use for social gatherings and other events. The hall would have been an integral part of creating a complete community within Canoe. In recent years, lacking the funds to do maintenance and repairs, the hall fell into disrepair. The old Victory Hall was sold for the price of the land, $50,000. It was bought by two good stewards, Tor and Ray Cooper. It was thought past restoring, but the Coopers didn't think so. They are no strangers to saving old buildings. They bought and restored the historic Methodist Church just across from Victory Hall, and it is now their home. Tor says, "It is not about money, it is about community. The Coopers have shown commendable community spirit." Almost a century after being built, Victory Hall has been saved from demolition. The hall is structurally the same as in early days, and the Coopers have endeavored to retain its former charm, with just a bit of new color and the addition of handicap access as well as more toilet facilities. During the years when the hall was unusable, two memorial plaques and the photo of John Hacken Lund were stored in a safe place in the archives of Salmon Arm Museum. At the grand reopening of the hall in March of 2017, the memorial plaques and the photo of John Lund were gifted back to the hall. Three Lund descendants attended the opening, and the ribbon was cut by Anna Lund. Tor and Ray Cooper have reinstated the Canoe Victory Hall name. Their innovative signs artwork depicts a 1919 penny with CVH inscribed upon it and the words Canoe Victory Hall below. If this hall could have memories, it would be of all those who have passed through its doors over almost 100 years, the spiritual use of many faiths, the meeting of friends and loved ones, the joy of music and dance, Christmas school concerts, activities of strength and endurance, planning for a better community, teaching of new skills, saying goodbye to loved ones who have passed on, and those who met and fell in love and became beautiful brides and dapper grooms. In short, beginnings and endings, music and drama, hopes and dreams, hellos and goodbyes, wins and losses, and much joy, laughter, and love have been shared with so many within these walls. Victory Hall's place is assured in the little community where it has been a major place for social events for so long, and will continue to serve the needs of the residents for many more years. After all, anything else would be disrespectful to those who fought and died in World War I and to whom this hall was dedicated. Canoe remains a quiet residential area today, part of the larger municipality of Salmon Arm, with a minimum of amenities. Its location, next to one of the best sandy beaches in the area, makes it a busy hive in the summer months. Residents of the community are very grateful that Victory Hall has been restored, and they look forward to the hall continuing to be an integral part of their community and a fitting memorial to not only those who served in both world wars, but to those who built Victory Hall.
The Harold and Florence Noakes family of Magna Bay, by Estelle Noakes, read by Estelle Noakes. My grandfather, Harold Edward Stanton Noakes, was born in Hastings, England, on March 14, 1879. As the youngest of 11 children, there was little opportunity for employment in the family business. Harold immigrated to Canada in 1896 at the age of 17. He was never to see England or his family again. Harold traveled by train to Winnipeg There he met the Barnett family, who had emigrated from Essex, England, a few years before. The family were comprised of George and Annie, sons George, James, and Edward, and daughter Florence, who was 13 years old at the time, but later would become my grandmother. Due to the severe winters in Winnipeg, the Barnett suggested that Harold travel further west to British Columbia. En route to the west, Harold heard of an employment opportunity near Kamloops with Mr. William Fortune, who had an extensive ranch at Tronchiel. Harold traveled to Kamloops and was successful in securing employment at the ranch, where he learned much about ranching, cowboy life, and the Canadian Western way of life. While there, he was asked to accompany the coroner as a witness to a death at Blind Bay. It was Harold's first introduction to Shuswap Lake, and he liked it so well he vowed to return. He worked for 4 years at the Fortune Ranch until giving in to the lure of new adventure and the quest for gold in the Yukon at Dawson City. In 1900, Harold traveled to the Yukon by boat up the west coast of British Columbia, then by rail and riverboat to Dawson City. He was 2 years after the mass exodus to the Yukon, and hence did not have to carry his goods over the Chilkoot Pass, but could travel in comfort by rail. He staked quite a few gold claims around Dawson City, some with a bit of success. After 6 years in the Yukon, he and his fellow miners became aware of a large dredging company that was sent in to rework old diggings previously worked by hand. The dredging was trespassing on private claims. Harold was well educated, so the miners prevailed upon him to present their grievance to Prime Minister Sir Wilfrid Laurier. Harold sold his claims before traveling to Ottawa. Upon completion of his mission in Ottawa, Harold traveled to Victoria. He had kept in contact with the Barnett family, who had since relocated to Victoria. Harold found employment at a chemical company and renewed his friendship with the Barnett family. He and Florence were married in 1908. Sons Harold Stanton and Albert Victor were born over the following years. In the fall of 1911, Harold heard of a Mr. McGuinn wishing to sell improvements to a preemption of Magna Bay, then Steamboat Bay, on the North Shuswap. Traveling to Kamloops, Harold met Mr. McGuinn, and the transaction was completed. While in Kamloops, he rode out to Tronchiel. On the return trip, he was thrown from his horse. The horse rolled on him, causing a broken leg and some internal injuries. This accident caused a delay in taking possession of the property at Magna Bay until June of 1912 and caused him grief the rest of his life, often preventing him from doing physical labor. Harold, Florence, and their two sons arrived in Chase just in time for the Dominion Day celebrations. They stayed at the Underwood Hotel and made arrangements with Mr. Jock Haldane to transport them to Magna Bay, leaving their possessions to come later by steamer. At Magna Bay, they discovered another couple squatting on their property, and the squatters had used the logs that Mr. McGuinn had left them to help build a dwelling. Fortunately, Harold had registered the land in his name, and his right to the property was not disputed. He allowed the squatters to move to the other end of the property and erect a cabin. The family camped on the beach in two tents while the house was being built. The lumber, purchased from Adams River Lumber Company in Chase, should have arrived about the same time as the family, but they soon found that their order had been loaded on a barge and left during the July 1st celebrations. The barge sank and the lumber was lost. By the time the lumber was replaced and delivered, it was quite a race to get the walls up and the roof on before inclement weather set in. Even so, it rained during the shingling of the roof and the floors got wet. Mr. Pete King, with his horse and stone boat, hauled the household goods up from the beach. The piano was carried up by a crew of husky men. Mr. McGuinn had started an orchard, and the family was able to harvest apples that first fall. In the spring, a garden was planted, and the process of cultivating and clearing land began. Harold's leg continued to cause him grief, so Florence taught school at Celista from 1914 to 1916. During the spring of 1915, Harold returned to Victoria to have his leg rebroken and reset. He was unable to tolerate anesthetic, so it was a painful process. At a school board meeting in the spring of 1916, a bachelor proposed a motion not to employ married women as teachers. With a predominantly bachelor population, they were anxious to entice prospective wives to the community. The motion passed. This was a difficult decision for the Noakeses, with Harold unable to work and medical bills accumulating. Florence needed to teach elsewhere, and she taught at Pritchard from 1916 to 1918. The summer of 1918, the family moved back to Victoria, where Harold was employed in the shipyards. The employment was short-lived as ship construction declined with the end of the war. The family returned to the shoe swap in 1919. In 1923, Florence was offered a teaching position at Anglemont. She was also asked to bring along one of her sons so they could fulfill their quota of students. Florence agreed, providing her sons could take alternate weeks attending school. She prepared lessons for the ones staying home. Florence taught at Anglemont from 1923 to 1925. In the fall of 1925, Harold was offered a job at Adams River Lumber Company in Chase, but shortly after, the mill closed and the family moved to Kamloops. Harold secured a job at CN, where he worked until the economic downturn of 1929. In 1930, Harold and Florence returned to their home in the Shuswap Lake. Florence continued to teach and Harold to farm. They both taught music and continued with the Noakes Family Orchestra, joined by their sons when at home. Harold gained the nickname the Socialist Noakes, partly for his belief that all people were equal, and partly due to his avid support of Tommy Douglas, leader of the CCF Party, now the NDP. During the Second World War, an internment camp for Japanese was at Magna Bay. Harold and Florence assisted the Japanese people as much as they could, as well as helping them when they were released at the end of the war. Quite a few families stayed at a cabin on the Noakes property during this transition. Harold and Florence remained in their home until their health failed, and in 1965 they moved to Prince George to live with their son Bert and his wife Helen. Harold passed away that same year. Florence remained bright and alert. She believed in learning something new every day. She tried painting, and she enrolled in night school, taking typing, the oldest student to do so at that time. She passed away in 1967. The Noakes home at Magna Bay is presently owned and lived in by Helen Lockerbie. Son Stan worked for the Forest Service and resided in Kamloops with his wife Madge and three sons. Son Bert worked in various jobs through the years. He lived with his wife Helen on the nursery swap, Winfield, and then Prince George. Bert and Helen had nine children.
George Abbott was not the first Shuswap politician that rose to prominence in Victoria. Sycamus pioneer and renowned lumberman Rolf Walgreen Bruin was first elected to the legislature in 1924, and during his long political career, he served as a cabinet minister and became well known for his honesty, independence, and sincerity. Interestingly, Abbott wrote the only biography of Bruin that is also available online. Born in 1878, Rolf grew up in Sweden, the son of Alex Walgren, a crown reeve who, after being accused of embezzlement, fled alone to Canada and changed his name to Bruin. The Walgreen family was left in dire straits, and Rolf and his siblings had to work hard after school to help make ends meet. After winning a raffle, he gave the bulk of his proceeds to his mother and used the rest to buy a ticket to Canada, where he too changed his name to Bruin. After working as a sailor on the Great Lakes, he joined his father in Maliqua, where he took up a homestead and married Anna Treat, a recent immigrant from Missouri. As is the case now, farmers then had to supplement their incomes with other jobs. Brune chose government roadwork, and he soon became a foreman and then a superintendent. In 1910, the family moved to Salmon Arm, where 4 years later, he also began his career in politics when he was elected as an alderman in 1914. During World War I, Brune supervised the construction of the road along the east shoreline of Merrill Lake that was built by German internees who were camped at 2 Mile and at Hummingbird Creek. In the early 1900s, politics influenced government employment, and thus when the Liberals replaced the Conservatives in 1916, Brune, along with other road superintendents, lost his job. He moved back to Sicamous in 1917 and started a forestry business that became his lifelong venture and also helped shape the future of the Shuswap. Beginning with selling cedar poles, Brune's company grew rapidly into a diversified forest company that included poles, logs, railroad ties, and lumber mills in Sicamous and Canoe. In 1918, Brune suffered a major setback when he was severely burned when an explosion destroyed his launch. He barely survived by diving into the water, and during the many months of hospitalization and surgery, his wife Anna managed to keep the company going. Brune lived the rest of his life with major scars that required special care, but also served as a sign of his courage and dynamism. When the redistribution of provincial electoral boundaries resulted in a new riding for Salmon Arm, Brune decided to run for the Conservatives. Even though the Liberals regained power in 1924, Salmon Arm elected Brune, who served his constituency well with his independent, nonpartisan approach that even included voting at times to support Liberal government bills. Despite his maverick approach, he was unanimously nominated again in 1928 and won that election with an overwhelming majority. Finally, the Conservative Party regained power after 12 years in opposition, and Brune was appointed the president of the Executive Council. When the Depression hit, he advocated for using unemployment relief for public works projects, including the construction of the Trans-Canada Highway. In 1930, he was chosen to be the Minister of Public Works, which became exceedingly frustrating as much-needed federal funding was difficult to access and public work camps were closed and replaced by direct relief. Brune's timber business also suffered during the Depression, and at times he ran his company at a loss just to keep his workers and suppliers employed. He also frequently provided his own funds to assist families in need. Despite being a conservative, Brune advocated for public works and minimum wages, all too radical for his colleagues. When he supported his constituents' request for a coalition, it was rejected, and he resigned from the party to serve as an independent. As a backbencher, Brune had more time to focus on his businesses. He sold the Canoe Mill in 1936 and purchased a home in Vancouver, where he became busy with mining projects and took time off to travel. Just prior to the 1941 election, Brune returned to the Conservative Party, and when they joined with the Liberals in a coalition government, he once again became the Minister of Public Works until he passed away suddenly from a stroke in 1942. The Shuswap region was fortunate to be served by a pioneer politician and businessman with so much integrity, energy, and fairness as Ralph Brune. Ralph's contribution to the Shuswap region was enormous. Not only was he a well-respected politician, he was also a community builder. His forestry enterprises employed many, including those who worked directly for his companies and those who supplied the company with materials. As a politician, Brune attended events throughout his riding, including many community events. Brune's nonpartisan, independent politics should serve as a model to politicians today. His concern for his constituents and for the overall good of society trumped the demands of his political party. We remember him today because the highway bridge over the Sicamous Channel is named the Ralph Brune Memorial Bridge.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
Seymour City During the Big Bend Gold Rush by Estelle Noakes. The Gold Rush City at the end of Seymour Arm of Shuswap Lake was originally called Ogdensville or Ogden City. On March 6, 1866, it officially became Seymour City in honor of Frederick Seymour, then governor of the Crown Colony of British Columbia. The Surveyor General of British Columbia notified the community that the town site would be laid out and lots sold by auction on Saturday, June 9th at noon. The government had a plan for future buildings, and this was passed on April 23, 1866. A bakery, saloon, two butcher stores, and a hotel were to be future additions. The Victoria colonists stated April 23, 1866, "This place, at present, consists of about 20 buildings, finished and building, there being two butcher shops, one hotel, one saloon, one baker, and two general stores. The steamboat landing has been selected by Mr. Joseph McKay, who is now here, and it is a few hundred feet below the present buildings. The first death took place yesterday, being that of a man named Henry Evans, formerly of the Caribou, and, I believe, an American by birth. Business is duller here at present than it has been all winter, and will continue so until the lakes open, as most of the miners have left for the creeks, and no large numbers of fresh arrivals can be looked for until the boats are able to reach here. Flour, which appears the most abundant article all through the country, being 20 cents per pound, beans, 45 cents, bacon, $1.25, candles, $1.50, other things in proportion. No fresh vegetables of any kind whatsoever are to be procured at present, but they can be got quite readily as soon as the lake opens. Meals, very good ones, considering, are $1.50. About 200 men are, at present, computed to be in the Big Bend district, but I believe none have got through on the Columbia route yet. By May of 1866, Seymour City had become a sizable town of about 500 people, and the Hudson Bay Company's S.S. Martin began to supply it. In May, a fire broke out and consumed some buildings, including a store with $10,000 worth of merchandise. The first newspaper at Seymour City went out on June 21, 1866. It was called the Town Crier, or Seymour Charivari. It contained advertisements, an excellent introductory article, some racy bits, and a la punch cartoons. The paper later turned into a weekly manuscript. Seymour also had its own postage stamp. August was the closing of the 1866 season. A letter at that time states, "Notwithstanding the many disappointed, sore-footed, light-pocketed, bootless and pantless specimens of the genus Homo returning from Seymour, everyone must feel quite satisfied that despite the drawbacks of a very late and severe season, these mines will turn out to be the great El Dorado of British Columbia." Mr. H.P. Featherston reports on August 29, 1867. "This once flourishing village is fast going to decay. There were 24 inhabitants left, including 8 stragglers, 2 Indians, and 6 wholesale merchants. Out of 30 cabins, 15 are empty." The government subsidy of $400 a month for the S.S. Martin service to Seymour City was discontinued. The end of this era of Seymour's history came in October of 1867, when Chief Factor W.F. Tolmie ordered the closing of the post at Seymour. all goods, windows, and any other movable object of value were taken to Kamloops. The last trip of the 49 was made in November 1866 from Colville. The SS Martin had an accident the winter of 1867 and thereafter became useless. In July of 1869, Jean Laveau brought the steamer to Kamloops. After a lapse of 9 years, the SS Martin was again in service, providing regular trips for the Savannah Ferry's freight. It is noted in 1876 that she provided passage from Savannah to Kamloops for Their Excellencies Lord and Lady Dufferin. The SS Martin grounded on a rock in Kamloops Lake, October of 1877. So ended the career of the first Thompson River steamer. On January 1st, 1869, the Victoria Colonist stated that three men who had been left in charge of the Martin robbed her of nearly every movable article. This same gang stripped the remains from Seymour City during the same period, in some instances wantonly destroying items. Later, a fire struck the old town and destroyed most of the buildings, but a few cellars remained to indicate that they were once lived in. The collapse of the Big Bend Rush, coupled with a decrease in returns from the Cariboo, threw the province of BC into a recession. After 3 years of frenetic activity, Seymour settled back into quiet solitude, undisturbed except for some logging activities. Sequemec People, Earliest Inhabitants of Seymour Arm, by Estelle Noakes. Little is known of these indigenous people, as they left no written records, but archaeologists have documented their existence on the Shuswap Lakes and Thompson River systems for over 9,000 years. For centuries, the area now known as Seymour Arm existed in quiet solitude, inhabited only by the Shuswap Indian tribes, the Sequemec, who gathered in the summer to harvest the salmon from one of the largest runs in British Columbia. They also came to pick the abundant berries and to hunt for game. Often raided by the Blackfoot and Stoney Nakoda tribes from the Alberta Plains, the depictions of the battles are shown on rock faces and caves around Shuswap Lake in the form of Indian paintings called pictographs. The trail used by the Alberta Indians on their raids was destined to become one of the routes the prospectors took on their way to the Columbia Goldfields from Seymour Arm in 1865. Travel was either by walking or paddling dugout canoes constructed from birch bark or cottonwood. In summer, the Sequemec camped in temporary summer houses similar to teepees, but made with pine poles covered with bulrushes and reed mats. In winter, they settled into semi-subterranean pit houses called kikulis. There is no evidence of winter settlement at Seymour Arm, probably due to the high snowfalls of the Seymour region. Dried salmon was a staple food. Deer, as well as other mammals, provided meat, and their fur and skin were essential for clothing. These people were remarkable for their stone, bone, and wood tools. To hunt and fish, they used snares, bone spears, nets, and bow and arrow. The men were excellent carvers, using complex and symbolic designs. The women wove intricate baskets using geometric patterns. Next to hunting and fishing, these early people relied on plants for food, medicine, and for physical and spiritual well-being. Clothing was made from animal skins and tree fibers. The Sequemec lived with great respect for their environment. Dances and drum songs were part of their traditions, as well as vision quests. They had a rich and vibrant culture, which included many spiritual ceremonies to honor and celebrate events. the exploits of Coyote, who was sent to put the world in order, are found at the center of many myths and legends. The eagle has special spiritual significance. For more information on these First Peoples, visit the Sequemec Museum in Kamloops or the Mary Thomas Center in Salmon Arm.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceoftheshuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.